From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The best museums present history in context, but sometimes less flattering aspects of the past are glossed over or ignored. Tomorrow, curators at Telfair Museum's Owens Thomas House in Savannah unveil an unvarnished relic of history, refurbished slave quarters at the Regency-era mansion. And we're going to take a virtual tour with GPB's Cindy Hill in just a moment. But first, Shannon Browning Mullis is curator of history and decorative arts for Telfair Museums, and she's joining us from Savannah. Hello, Shannon.
Good morning.
How did renovations and happenstance lead to what became a multi-decade project unveiling tomorrow?
You know, it's been a long process. The slave quarters and carriage house at the Owens Thomas House had been turned into apartments by the last owner of the house in the early 20th century. So it wasn't until 1990, when the last tenants moved out, that the museum went in to renovate, and I think they really thought they'd get new offices or storage space. But what they found when they pulled down drop plaster ceilings and walls was that the original features were still there. So they had fireplaces, they had original ceilings with haint blue paint, and they realized early on that they needed to restore this space and fully tell the story of all the people, free and enslaved, who lived on the site. And it's been quite a process to do the research to put these exhibits in and be able to tell this story.
Well, you said that Savannah has not always been quick to highlight stories of slavery at the time. Why was that?
Well, I don't think it's an unusual situation in Savannah. I think for many years, people glossed over the story of slavery in America generally. More recently, we've certainly seen some museums and some cities start to embrace a full history. So you've seen moves at places like Monticello and Montpelier to start telling those stories. And we think it's important that to have a full, authentic history, every historic site in every city has to acknowledge their full past, the good parts and the less attractive parts.
But that's now, and there are loads of other museums, the Memorial for Peace and Justice, for example, in Montgomery, telling full pictures. But this was in the 1990s when you discovered this. So if that was the thinking, why did Telfair decide to invest so much time and money, really, in bringing the slave quarters to public view?
You know, I have to say it was before my time there, but I very much respect the decisions of the board and the staff that was there at the time in recognizing that this is, you know, a part of the story, whether we like it or not, and that this is, as far as we know, the only intact urban slave quarters open to the public in the city of Savannah. Mm. So you may have other slave quarters that are today townhomes or apartments or shops, but they're not open so that the public can see them as they were. So it's a real responsibility and an honor for us to be able to tell that history.
Well, the exhibit highlights stories of three enslaved people in the Owens House. Who were they? What do we know about them?
Well, first I'll say that, you know, we do know that between 8 and 14 enslaved people lived and worked on the property at any given time from 1819 until the Civil War. So we do touch on all that history. But there are three people who we have a little bit more information about than anybody else. So Peter was the enslaved butler for the Owens family who lived in the house for many, many years. Diane was the enslaved cook for the family. And Emma, who is probably the most intriguing figure in our history, was the enslaved nursemaid who raised their children.
Why so intriguing? What do we know about Emma?
You know, I think because of her position and because of her interaction with the family, they wrote more about her in their correspondence than they did about anybody else, or at least any other enslaved person. Which means that as we piece together this history using census records, tax records, wills, but especially that correspondence, that we can just learn a little bit more about her and her life. So we know, for example, that she was with the family at this property for decades. We know that George Owens took her to Philadelphia for medical treatment at one point, which is quite unusual. But we also know that the family put her in the Savannah jail for safekeeping overnight at one point. Hmm. So a complex story about people who lived in very close circumstances and had to have a very complicated relationship.
I think so often when we walk into these museum or preserved homes and we think, oh, it's beautiful and full of antiques and your imagination gets going, how has included including the stories of not just these three, Emma, Peter, and Diane, but all of the enslaved people, changed that museum experience?
You know, it's a different experience. I think, you know, historically, we had a lot of historic house museums focused on architecture and decorative arts. The large majority still are. But the reality is that while people may want to hear about the fancy dinners and the beautiful ball gowns, those things didn't exist without the people who were sewing those dresses, who were cooking that food, and who were serving those dinners. And in addition to that, the wealth that created that lifestyle didn't exist without plantation labor and the domestic slave trade and the other ways that wealth was made off of human beings. So we have to fully acknowledge that history, and it creates an extremely different experience for our visitors, which is one of the reasons that we decided it was such an important thing for us to change the name of the property from the Owens Thomas House to the Owens Thomas House and Slave Quarters, so that our visitors know up front that the story we're telling is about all the people who lived here and what their lives were like.
Shannon Browning Mullis is curator of history and decorative arts for Telfair Museums. And tomorrow is the public unveiling of the historic slave quarters at Telfair's Owens Thomas House. We've got a little bit of an audio tour with GPB's Cindy Hill, who joined Shannon for an early look at the renovations.
The building that we're in right now on both sides, this is the original carriage house, so horses and carriages on first floor, hayloft up above, and then next door was the two-story slave quarters.
Come on through.
This house existed not on a plantation, but in a city, which is something people don't often understand. George Owens, who purchased this property in 1830, was an attorney. He was a politician, but most of his wealth came from the eight plantations on which over 400 people were enslaved. So the important thing to understand here is we had between 8 and 14 enslaved people on the site, but the money that generated the ability to live in this way came from over 600 individuals' lives. And so the pieces of wood that you see behind you are representative of those people. When this is done, it will cover the wall, and you'll see over 300 names that we have. But you also see blank tiles for the people who we know existed on these plantations, but whose names we were not able to recover yet. So we are in the slave quarters. Both levels of this building did serve as slave quarters before the Civil War. The ceiling that you see here, the fireplace that you see here, even that center strip of floor there are original to the building, which is pretty exceptional. This is the only intact urban slave quarters that's open to the public in the city of Savannah. The paint that you see there is really important to us. It is haint blue paint, so made and applied by the enslaved people who lived here as part of their own spiritual practice. Let's walk upstairs and take a look. This space is the second floor of the slave quarters, and what we are doing here, of course, we don't know what furnishings these people had. You know, we have inventories of the main house and the expensive furnishings that were there. We don't have that for this building, but we do have WPA narratives that talk about things people had in different places when they were enslaved. And so what we're doing here is interpreting three different vignettes of the ways people might have lived and furnished their spaces. So we have one that is a rope bed, which you see here, and the story would be that this is a hand-me-down from the house, something that would have been used until it was worn, and then they passed it on to the slave quarters. We'll also have a bed that would have been constructed by enslaved people from materials they were able to acquire themselves. And then we have a pallet on the floor for people who would not have had beds, because we know there were many people who were enslaved that did not have actual beds. Do you want to have a look at the basement and see the rest of the new exhibits? So we're still wrapping this room up, but this door will be open so that you can see the tools they would have used on a daily basis. This is the cellar. I've never been to another site where you could go into the cellar, so I'm very excited about it. It's where everything would have been stored at the time. And then the cabinet that's behind you here, when it's complete, will be interactive so people can open the doors and learn about power and access. So what did Diane, the enslaved cook, have access to on a daily basis? And then what things did Sarah Owens come down and unlock when it was needed? Formal dinners absolutely happened here. Beautiful dresses absolutely happened here. But those things didn't exist without somebody in the basement washing those dresses and cooking that food.
GPB Cindy Hill brought us that audio postcard of a visit to the Owens Thomas House and Slave Quarters, opening up tomorrow, in Savannah. And want to make a note here, GPB Education is creating a virtual field trip to the Owens Thomas House and Slave Quarters. It's going to launch next fall. But this is one of the things that we do here at GPB Education, a free classroom resource aligned to standards, and you get to explore the revitalized house, 360-degree video, interactive elements, primary source documents, and also a virtual reality component. Now, this is just a fascinating find and a fascinating opening in Georgia history. I'm wondering for you, Shannon, you said these blank tiles, names we're not able to get records of yet. So this project is continuing.
Sure. Historical research is never complete. There's always one more document out there, one more story that's been told and recorded somewhere. So we won't stop trying to uncover all the details of these people's lives that we can. We know that Richard Richardson, who originally commissioned the house, was a trader in the domestic slave trade, and we've recovered shipping manifests that name 200 people he shipped out of the port of Savannah to be sold in New Orleans. But we know we don't have all those manifests and we don't have all those names, and so we're not telling the full, complete story. So, you know, stay tuned. We're opening a lot of fantastic, exciting new exhibits tomorrow, but there'll always be more information to come.
We know that when the National Museum of African American History and Culture opened in D.C., also the National Memorial of Peace for Injustice in Montgomery, the new Civil Rights Museum in Jackson, sometimes the response from the public is, well, you know, why bring this up again? Why again talking about this negative side of history? What's your response to that?
Well, I have two responses to that. One would be the more philosophical response, I guess, that is, why wouldn't we? If our job is to tell history, to tell the story, and half the people who lived on this property were enslaved, then at a very base level, we're just not doing our job unless we're telling their story as well. We're presenting a fairy tale, not an actual history. But on another level, I think we can all look around and honestly say that everyone in our country is not experiencing equal opportunities or equal lives at this moment. And I think unless we go back and really examine the root of where that inequality started, we will have a lot harder time getting to solutions today and in the future.
Yeah, sometimes people find it hard to look at the historical mistreatment of blacks in the U.S., but this is about, in some ways, the future. Can we make that argument?
I can certainly make that argument personally. We will have to have our visitors decide if they can make that argument themselves. But I think it's so important.
Shannon Browning Mullis, congratulations on finally bringing this to the public, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Shannon Browning Mullis is Curator of History and Decorative Arts for Telfair Museum. Tomorrow is the public unveiling of the museum's Owens Thomas House and Slave Quarters. It's Transgender Awareness Week, and today we are marking it with muscle. TransFitCon is the world's only transgender bodybuilding competition, and it is held in Atlanta. A recent documentary called Man-Made follows the lives of four trans men as they prepare their physiques and psyches for the event. Man-Made transcended and won the Documentary Feature Jury Award earlier this year at the Atlanta Film Festival. On Second Thought, guest host Adam Ragusa spoke with filmmaker and trainer T. Cooper and to Reese Weaver, who's featured in the film.
I heard about this competition, and I was just as surprised as most people that it existed and started looking into it. I'm a journalist and a writer by trade, so my first impulse was to write a story about it. And I pitched it to a couple publications, New York Times Magazine, places like that. They were super interested. But the minute I got into the story and started meeting these guys like Reese and Mason and learning their stories, I just immediately knew I had to turn this into a film and figure out a way to get a camera on my shoulder and do that.
Yeah. Well, bodybuilding makes for great footage. When I heard about the existence of your documentary and therefore learned about the competition, my reaction was not surprise. I was like, oh, that totally makes sense. That totally makes sense because transitioning from one sex to another is all about changing one's body through sheer force of will and sometimes surgery and pharmaceuticals. And that's kind of what bodybuilding is about generally. And also just a lot of the hormones that are used for sex reassignment therapies are the same hormones used by bodybuilders generally for their anabolic effect to help build muscles. Do I have that right, Reese?
Yeah, you have it correct.
So, yeah, I suppose it just makes all the sense in the world. The film follows four trans men's lives outside of the competition. There's Mason, Dominic, Reese, who's with us, and Kenny. Mason is one of the lightweight bodybuilders. Here is Mason talking about why he competes in these competitions.
Bodybuilding has meant a ton for me because it helped me transition and change my body before I could actually get on testosterone.
Interesting. So Reese, being one of the trans men in this film, why is bodybuilding important to you?
Bodybuilding is important to me because it's my passion. And it has nothing to do with my transition. And it has everything to do with just mentally. When I enter the gym, I just lift up the weight and everything in the world doesn't bother me. I don't have to worry about anything. I don't have to worry about what people think. And it's a very inspiring atmosphere.
Right. It's a yoga. It's a discipline. It's a way of focusing oneself.
Correct.
Unfortunately, though, in the film, we see that you trained for the show and then you weren't able to attend because your flight got delayed. That must have been devastating.
Yeah, that was a complete bummer.
Yeah. Well, I think for people who don't know about this, you know, you can't just decide that you want to do one of these competitions and then a month later do it. How long were you prepping for this?
I took about 2 years because I had to lose a lot of body fat. Mm-hmm. And also you have to carve it. It's just like a canvas. You're making a work of art. So it takes time and effort and meal prepping. It's a long journey, basically.
Yeah. While you were filming the documentary, one of the subjects, Dominic, had what is called top surgery. For listeners who don't know what top surgery is, this is a procedure to create a male contoured chest. Specifically, it's a double mastectomy. Where you graft the nipple back on. Here is a clip of Dominic before he received his surgery.
I'm ready to just throw a shirt on and not have to, you know, readjust and be like, hold on a second, let me tuck in my binder, you know. I just want to be free, man.
Wow, T, what was it like to be a fly on the wall for that process and for the unveiling of that new physique after the surgery?
Yeah, well, it was obviously super powerful and emotional. What's so cool about it is that in the course of the film, we filmed at two FitCon competitions, and that's where I met Dominic, was at the first one, and that was pre-surgery. Obviously, he had, you know, had still breast tissue, and then he was going to have surgery and then train for the second competition. So to see such utter emotional, psychological, and also, of course, physical transformation was just super moving. And as, you know, a trans person myself who went through something similar, just to get to be in that intimate space with him and to be welcomed into that world was really moving. You know, I sat in that ER and filmed, mm-hmm. you know, a 6-7 hour surgery and then was with him for a week of recovery. So, you know, it was very intimate. And I think it shows up in the film.
Yeah. Yeah. On the one hand, it's incredible that you were able to get the kind of access that you needed in order to tell the story about these trans men preparing for bodybuilding competition. But on the other hand, I suppose just the very fact that they were doing what they were doing indicates that they were ready to let it all hang out, right? Like to compete in one of these competitions, you gotta strip down and just stand in front of a hall full of people and have every nook and cranny of your body scrutinized. So I suppose they were ready.
Yeah, that was actually one of the things that was most striking to me, was just what it takes to stand in front of people and be judged in literally like the skimpiest piece of material you've ever seen in your life with just, you know, millimeters between all of you and the audience. So that's constantly surprising to me. I don't think I would ever do it, you know, no matter what I looked like. And so that was, yeah, I mean, it just takes a lot of nerve to do that. And it's impressive. And, you know, my hat was off to them all the time for not only letting me into their, you know, physical lives, but also their intimate and emotional lives.
Yeah. Reese, what's it like to stand up and do that?
For me, It's more about representing for people who haven't had top surgery, because I'm pre-op and I want people to know that it's okay to own your body, be proud of who you are. Everybody transitions differently in its process to these things, because everybody can't get surgery overnight. So when we had this opportunity and I heard about FitCon, I didn't hear about it till the second year, and it was something that I felt that I had to do because I want to motivate other people to feel like it's okay to be a man and to not have top surgery.
Yeah, one of the really striking things we see in the film is the incredible diversity of the physiques that we see on that stage. We see people who, you know, you would, unless you knew that they were trans, you would never guess, right? And then other people in various stages of transition, and people who haven't transitioned at all, and everyone up there doing the same thing and being judged against one another. It was just it was a really remarkable thing to see. We're speaking with T. Cooper, director and writer of the award-winning film Man Made. It's a documentary about the world's only transgender bodybuilding competition, which happens in Atlanta. Also with us is one of the subjects of the film, Reese Weaver. Let's listen to one more clip here. In the documentary, after Mason competes in a competition in which he does not disclose being transgender, his sister says this.
I think the intricacies of bodybuilding appeal to the control and getting to the place where, you know, he's literally his own man.
T, do you think she has that right there?
Yeah, 100%. And you can see it in his face and his body and just the way he carries himself, that, you know, he comes into himself when he's on stage. And it's not about being macho. It's not about being some super, like, roided out Hulk dude. You know, this is his life, and this is how he is the best man for himself, for his wife, for his family, for his eventual children. It's just really beautiful.
Sure. But you said the R word there, roids. What role do we see drugs playing in this film?
To be honest, it's an issue that has not really been taken on in the bodybuilding world, because none of these guys is taking any more testosterone than the average cisgender or non-trans man. Mm-hmm. As Mason even says in the film, you know, he hasn't been on testosterone as long as the rest of the guys that he's competing against. And of course, we're talking about not trans FitCon, but other mainstream bodybuilding competitions. And, you know, in a way, he's playing catch up. There's no doping at all. He's getting his levels where everybody else's are. So, you know, I obviously bodybuilding is rife with that. But, you know, these guys, I don't think we didn't get into super much of that, because they're just taking, you know, hormone replacement therapy to get to where they need to be to live their lives.
It's a less fraught subject in this particular area of bodybuilding than it is in bodybuilding generally, because so many of the cisgendered pro bodybuilders out there are probably getting their anabolic drugs illegally, whereas I imagine a lot of the folks featured in your film are prescribed them as part of their hormone, as part of their sex reassignment therapies. And that ironically makes it a less fraught topic, which is, one of the 10 million super interesting dimensions about this story that you stumbled upon, T, and I'm so glad that you were able to tell it in your film. So enough with the bodybuilding geekery, and let's talk about some other dimensions that are touched on in the film, simply the life of being a trans person. Reese, in this film, we see that you have a son, Demonte, and in the movie he addresses you as mommy. Have you talked to him about calling you daddy, or do you care?
This is an issue, a question that I always come across with everyone who does an interview with me.
Sure.
And I just want the world to know that my son is my son, and whatever he chooses to identify me as, mother, father, it doesn't matter. He's my child. He's my seed. I love him. Mm-hmm. And so often in society, we get caught up in mother, father, you know, stuff like that. It shouldn't matter. As long as your child loves you, it doesn't matter what he calls me. And I'm biologically his mother, and he knows this. And he's exposed to the trans community, and he knows that I'm trans, but I'm his mother at the end of the day.
We see, though, in the film, you, Reese, encountering problems that are unique to the trans community. We see that you were homeless for a while, and you couldn't find anywhere to stay because Atlanta didn't offer homeless shelters that were safe and inviting to trans people. What was that experience like?
It was a very terrible experience. I felt very dysphoric. I felt very depressed. I felt less than. I thought, how could an animal get shelter and food and water, but me, a trans man, I'm denied human necessities of living?
So what's a solution to that problem that the cities and states could be thinking about?
To allow trans individuals to have housing. I mean, we're no different from anyone else. We're human. We bleed the same as anyone else. So why can't we have housing? If we identify as male, why can't we be put on the male side? If we identify as female, why can't we be put there?
T. Cooper, when you were making this film, what were the other sort of non-bodybuilding things that we see going on in this movie that really struck you?
Well, you know, as again, as a trans person, I just don't feel like I saw my stories, especially trans male stories, represented on screen. And so for me, the approach was always, yeah, bodybuilding. That's super interesting and all. And we're building toward that as a structure. But really, it was the 360-degree nature of these guys' lives and the things that they went through that are just universal. I mean, finding where you come from, you know, meeting a biological parent, breakups, makeups, job stuff, wife stuff, you know, the homelessness, the violence that Reese and his partner Tia's friend encountered in Baltimore, you know, violence against trans people, but also, you know, just fatherhood, motherhood. I mean, it's all in there. It's all there's a little bit of something for everybody. And it was very important for me to show the richness of these lives and the texture that is there while they are, you know, working on this external stuff. There's also all this internal stuff that's always going on. And of course, the metaphor of bodybuilding and turning yourself into the person that you want to be. I mean, we all do that. We all, as humans, the minute we're born to the minute we leave, we are changing, we're adapting, we're growing, we're changing. And you know, that affects those around us and ourselves. So that was always going to be the focus. You know, they could have been ice boat fishermen up in Alaska.
Reese, as T mentioned there, one of the things that we see in the film is that one of you and your wife's friends, Crystal, was shot and killed in Baltimore for disclosing that she was a trans woman, and she was also African-American. Being an activist in the trans community, what would you say are some of the particular dimensions of being a person of color who is trans?
It's very hard, and I feel like so often murders go unsolved. They don't try to solve them, and I feel like we're less than. And I just don't understand it. We're just people trying to live our lives, and it's just like we can't.
So in the last minute that we've got here, let's see if we can drum up some business for TransFitCon the next time it's held in Atlanta. T, if somebody were to show up to this event, what would they experience?
You know, it's a little bit of inside bodybuilding, inside trans life. It's, you know, there's a lot more than just the competition. I don't know the details of what's coming up with the next one, but mm-hmm. if it goes according to plan, I think there will be seminars, and I hope that we will be showing man-made the bodybuilding, you know, the film there at the competition. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, it's like a space for a bunch of different people of different experiences, ages, sizes, stages of transition, to get together and share and, you know, celebrate and be celebrated.
Reese, I know that you identify more as a power lifter than a bodybuilder. The distinction being powerlifting is about competing who can lift the most weight, as opposed to bodybuilding, which is about how your body looks. Do you think that you are going to try to compete in a bodybuilding show again, though?
No. I did bodybuilding to just encourage other people who were pre-op to come out there and try it, and I tried it. And I feel like I'm taking my journey elsewhere, and powerlifting is where I want to be. And I'm trying to conquer that. And I plan to be the first trans man, world's strongest man. And that's my goal right now. That's what I'm focusing on.
On Second Thought, guest host Adam Ragusa there interviewing T. Cooper and Reese Weaver from the documentary Man Made. Well, it is Transgender Awareness Week, and events are taking place around the state this weekend to spread awareness of the transgender community. Well, we've got a list of them on our website. That's at gpbnews.org. Up next, we'll check in with Football Friday's podcast host, John Nelson, and Pace magazine editor Josh Jackson recommends some new music and shows out this month. As we head into the break, one of them, a new record out from trans artist Laura Jane Grace and her band, The Devouring Mothers. Here's a bit of Apocalypse Now and Later. Stick around for more on Second Thought. If it's worth it to you, that's where I want to be. Bloomberg ranks Atlanta as the worst city for income inequality, and we're going to explore the real lives behind those numbers and how everybody is affected. Join us for that conversation on Mondays on Second Thought. Well, we are getting close to high school football championship time, and John Nelson is here. He's waving his arms up in the air. This is how he does it.
I do.
The fields get narrowed down for college bowl games. Finally, Super Bowl 53 right here in Atlanta, Georgia. And to get us in the spirit of the season, we're hearing from Atlanta's famous Frederick Douglass High School band.
Astro fans. And
also, whether you follow the game or the traditions that surround it, John Nelson, he's got the play-by-play. He's host of GPB's podcast Football Fridays in Georgia, and he's game correspondent for GPB TV. Thank you. We've got a Football Friday going on here.
That is accurate. Round two of the playoffs. It is Archer and Parkview, and we have all access pass at 7, kickoff a little after 7:30 on GPB, gpb.org, the GPB football app, which is downloadable. How's that for a promo?
You are good.
Right out of the blocks, you hit the promo.
This is not your first time. Any big stories coming out of the high school playoffs that are enough to make even non-sports fans, perhaps there may be some in the room, stand up and cheer?
Well, I think the little guy, if you want to look at it that way, you had 7 number 4 seeds go through the first round and knock off a bunch of teams, and you had some 3s knock off some 2s, and then you had dominance of some 1s. So depending on how you like to look at things from the bottom up or the top down, you had a lot of upsets in the first round, and you had a lot of the dominant teams put up big numbers as they get ready for the second round.
So what's interesting is so many teams have been successful this year, it literally, you don't know where to put them all. Can you explain that logjam between high school football championships and that other kind of football, F-U-T-B-O-L, football?
Well, I mean, you're looking at, when you're talking about the success of the high school football here in the South, Jeff Fisher, who does High School Football America, he has a fancy math that he did, and he does it every year. And for the first time ever in the history of his algorithm, he said that high school football in the state of Georgia is 3rd best in the country when it comes to placing players at the college level and things like that. So a lot of success for the state of Georgia as a top 5 when you're looking at placing players. And it's not just in the Southeast anymore. You'll have teams from out west. You'll have universities from out west in the Midwest and Northeast and Southwest. Everybody's coming to Georgia to get the talented players these days. And then, you know, when you're looking at the FUT, obviously you have to look at it. Atlanta United. I mean, that's one of the big stories there, and there's your synergy and your symmetry, because the championships are at the same place that Atlanta United's filling 72,000 people.
Well, we should mention that you also do play-by-play for Atlanta United's second team.
Yep.
Also co-host the Soccer Down Here podcast. So you're going to have a pretty busy December, right?
Yeah. Well, there is no silly season anymore, because with Atlanta United making it into CONCACAF Champions League, their season starts about 2 weeks earlier than it normally would. So they would be going to places like Honduras and Trinidad and things like that. And then with the USL, it's been a tremendous great thing to do. So it's been a lot of fun on a bunch of different levels. And so I'm trying to think of, okay, let's think about this. The championships, if Atlanta United doesn't make MLS Cup, the high school football championships will be the 7th and the 8th of December. If they do, then Atlanta United plays on December 8th, and the football championships get slid to midweek. The following week is National Signing Day, at least the first 3-day period for that. So that's your first group of your high school football players, FOOT, going to the college ranks. And then after that, you realize, oh, I forgot to buy Christmas gifts. and then you have like 4 days, and the folks who do the overnight shipping and things, they become really important in my life about December 21st.
They're all figuring into this, the scheme that is John Nelson. Well, John, one of the things you're great at doing is what's happening, of course, covering what's on the field, but also in the bleachers.
Yep.
And this is, you pay attention to fans in the bleachers and the bleachers themselves. So why is this part of the story in Northcutt Stadium in Marietta?
Well, with Northcutt, it was really cool because Northcutt is where Marietta High School plays. It's a city stadium in Marietta, and it was created as a WPA project back in the late 1920s. And what they did at the time when they created the stadium was they put a call out to all of the farmers in the area that we need all of your excess stone. And all of the farmers brought their stone to the facility, and that is the old wall that you see at Northcutt Stadium. And it had been covered over and sealed a couple different times over, and they've done some renovations in the last couple of years. But the western wall is still that old WPA project that was created in 1929. And I remember doing a stand-up at one of our games a couple of years ago where I was sitting on top of the wall and no one would help me off after I was done with my stand-up. So I was kind of marooned there for a little while.
That is so Georgia. Instead of a barn raising, it's a stadium raising.
Yep.
With everyone's leftover stone.
Yep.
Well, you've also toured South Georgia after Hurricane Michael
yep.
hit, saw the damage it left behind. So what role does football play in the story of communities trying to rebuild?
Well, it's a unifier, and what it does is it brings everything back into the community for just a little while. It gives you a bit of an escape. And when you go to places like the town of Colquitt, when you go to a place like Donaldsonville, and you see how everyone in the community is helping each other out, but at the same time, you get that respite and you get that unifier of community that high school football is. I mean, Seminole County, they lost their stadium. They couldn't play there the last couple of weeks of the season, so they were having to find venues and they were having to play games in other places. They didn't even open up the high school or any of the schools in the county until November 5th. So basically, the regular season was over by the time that you had folks able to go back in schools. But, you know, being able to catch up with folks like Wes Williams, the head football coach down there at Seminole County, and everybody down in Southwest Georgia, obviously we're still thinking about them a great deal. But just to see the unifier that it can give you on a Friday night, just to kind of be with everybody else in the community for a couple of hours, I think that's just a real cool thing.
And a tragedy on a very different scale.
Yep.
In Georgia. The 16-year-old Dylan Thomas
yeah.
died after being injured in a game in Pike County.
Right.
Football continues to be America's most watched sport, but are parents starting to bench their kids to keep them safe?
I think you're seeing a lot of NFL players who are making that decision these days, and you'll sit there and the NFL players, I think Kurt Warner was one who had decided that he was going to give his kids the choice as to whether or not they were going to play, and then there were other football players who are just like, nah, they're not going to do it because they perceive that the health risk outweighs the idea of playing that particular sport. And I will say this about everybody down in Zebulon at Pike County. They have been one of the great stories of the year, just as when I was down there the week after Dylan passed. And I have to give Miss Terry Patterson a great deal of credit. I called her because her son is one of the senior linemen, one mm-hmm. of the senior captains. And I said, I wanted to come down and I wanted to talk to everybody just to kind of see how everybody was doing. She's like, okay, you know, it's our fall break. I'll see what I can do. By the time I had gotten off the phone with her, she calls me a day later. We end up in a room with 16 Pike County moms to do a, basically a town hall, and you can look at that on our GPB Sports Facebook page. And it was a way for them just to kind of let everybody know how they were doing and how they're working their way forward. And Pike County, by the way, as one of those four seeds we were talking about at the beginning of the segment,
mm-hmm.
they won in overtime last week, knocking off a team on the road. They travel in round two of the playoffs to Savannah to take on Jenkins High, so their great story continues.
Well, and it also speaks to that unifying
yes.
power of football that you were talking about.
No doubt.
Well, we can't talk about football without noting that Atlanta is going to host the 2019 Super Bowl.
Never heard of it.
Right here in our fancy new Mercedes-Benz Stadium. So what are the odds, John, the Atlanta Falcons are going to actually play in the game?
Not good. Right now, they're 4-5 and taking on a Dallas in a must-win game with 2 4-5 teams that are going at it. So I would probably say if you're 8-8, 9-7, then you might get in the playoffs, but it's going to take a big run in the second half of the season for that to happen. Look for the LA Rams to be a big discussion, and former Marist quarterback Sean McVay, head coach.
Okay. Speaking of Georgia teams playing in the big games, what about the Bulldogs? How are they doing this year?
They're doing all right, and they're going to be in the SEC championship game, probably playing and doing as best they can against Alabama again for the second year in a row, considering they lost in the national championship last year. And the biggest question is, can the pride of Bainbridge, Georgia, Kirby Smart, come up with a game plan to knock off his mentor at Alabama, Nick Saban? And I think that's the big question a lot of Dogs fans have.
All right, before we go, we have to ask about Atlanta United.
Sure.
Big run this year.
Yes.
I mean, two seasons, the team has all but taken over Major League Soccer.
Epic.
Set attendance records,
yep.
Huge playoff run right now, just got ranked the most financially valuable team in the MLS.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who think kickers are only good for field goals, why might they turn on their TVs in November?
Well, I mean, right now, the home match on the 25th is leg one of the Eastern Conference Final, and what you're able to see is a team who is chasing after a title in their second year of existence. It's a very rare thing, and then leg two is on the 29th up in Harrison, New Jersey, for those that want to make the road trip. But I firmly anticipate that everybody who's a fan of the Five Stripes will be rowdy and proud on the 25th, and you'll have another 70,000 there as well. And I want to see what the support groups do for their TIFO in the end zone on the 25th. I think it's going to be a hoot.
Well, John Nelson, the game clock has run out on this conversation. He is host of GPB's podcast, Football Fridays in Georgia. He's also game correspondent for GPB TV. Thanks so much.
Hoo-ah!
Let's go!
After the Friday night lights fade, it's the weekend, and Josh Jackson is editor-in-chief of Pace Magazine. He's pulled together some staff picks for new music to listen to and to see. Josh, great to have you back with us.
Oh, great to be here.
Thank you. Well, we've got a full list of everything that he's going to recommend today, those we get to and those we don't. But first, new live album out from Jason Isbell, late of Athens, Georgia. Maybe I'd say the reigning king of country Americana with his band 400 Unit live from the Ryman. What do you want to tell us about this record?
Well, so if you don't know Jason Isbell, he was part of Drive-By Truckers, which is one of the great singer-songwriters of our time. And he was in the Ryman, which, you know, if he's the reigning king of Americana country, what better place than Nashville's Ryman, the former home of the Grand Ole Opry. And he spent several nights recording this from his last three albums. And it's a great live record.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Cumberland Gap.
There's a reason why I always reach for the harder stuff. It wasn't my daddy's way. He was down in the mines all day. I know he wanted more than mouths to feed and bills to pay. Maybe the Cumberland Gap just swallows you up.
Okay, so you got your drinking, you got your daddy, you got rural existentialism. Isbell has not been shy about getting sober or his progressive politics. How does that go over with the country crowd?
Well, I think with the Americana crowd, there's always been that vein of progressive politics going through the music. And you know, I'm sure that there's some people that are turned off by that, but his supporters, this is what they expect from him. Plays with his wife, Amanda Shires, who's a co-writer, had a great album of her own out, and helped him get clean back in 2012.
So we heard a little bit in the break from Laura Jane Grace and the Devouring Mothers, a new record called Bought to Rot. She is transgender, came out, I guess, about 6 years ago, announced that she was transitioning, very public about it. Is this still the focus of her songs?
Well, it certainly was of her first Against Me album after she came out 6 years ago, Transgender Dysphoria Blues. This album, you know, she stated, she told one of our writers that, you know, it's not always about just getting so personal that you're waking up in bed with the songwriter and feeling like you just know everything about her. So, yeah, surprised everybody 6 years ago, but has still got that same punk vibe to what she's doing now.
Well, so there's some big news in hip hop from television, a new series announced from Netflix. What did we hear?
So we have a brand new music competition series coming out called Rhythm and Flow. The judges are going to be Cardi B, Chance the Rapper, and Atlanta's own T.I.
We've heard of those people.
Yeah, and auditions are actually going to be here in Atlanta as well as New York and Chicago for breakout hip-hop stars. It's going to be coming out in the fall of 2019, and you've got 10 half-hour episodes.
Well, that sounds fascinating. A hip-hop breakout competition. But if you can't wait for that, we do have a talent search of our own, a competition tonight that draws singer-songwriters from all over the South. It's the open mic shootout at Eddie's Attic. So give us a little history on this.
Yeah, so I'm still waiting for the call from Netflix that they're going to pick this up as a TV. But yeah, there's a ton of history here. This will be the 48th shootout for Decatur's Eddie's Attic. Previous winners have gone on to do amazing things. Jennifer Nettles, who went on to help found Sugarland, John Mayer, Clay Cook, who was in the Zac Brown Band. So you have enormous amount of talent here in Atlanta, and this is a great opportunity to showcase. And you and I are going to be judges
tonight.
You
know, I'm sorry to say that I am going to be interviewing Christiane Amanpour, so I have to bow out.
That's
but you
a
know
good
what?
Excuse.
I'm glad because it is agonizing. It is so hard.
It's tournament style, so you have to. You might hear two just amazing performances, and you can only put one of them through to the next round. So yeah, it can be agonizing.
It's really hard. So many talented people, which is the most heartening thing about it. Okay, so another show for more established artists. You're excited about Kamasi Washington. He's going to be at the Buckhead Theater on November 17th. Let's hear a little bit of him. So he's a jazz guy.
Sax player and band leader. We've had him in the Pace Studio, and he's helped expand my idea of what jazz can be, just pulling in hip-hop, classical, R&B, all these elements. He's collaborated with everybody from Kendrick Lamar to Run the Jewels to John Legend, and yes, fantastic live player.
Super sharp dresser, I noticed by looking at his website.
He is indeed.
Speaking of sharp dressers, Migos and Drake are coming to on November 17th, Migos with Drake and without Drake on November 18th. So how's this tour been going between these two guys? I've read something about, you know, like a Ferrari floating above the auditorium in Miami.
Well, I mean, you've got just crazy grand performers here. And Migos have been so busy. So for a band known for sort of talking about partying all the time, they work their butts off. This will be, last year they had Culture come out. This year, Culture 2 with 24 tracks. They've got Culture 3 coming out next year. And then Takeoff and Quavo just released their solo album. So I can't believe how hard these guys work.
And I saw him in Carpool Karaoke, which was pretty good, with James Corden. They were singing the Whitney Houston song, Wanna Dance With Somebody. Somebody Who Loves Me. All right. Oldie Buddy Goodie, we're leaving with this one. Goodie Mob, the Atlanta artists, are going to be performing at the Tabernacle on November 21st. What can we expect when Goodie Mob comes back to town?
So everybody, you know, in Atlanta knows Outkast, but Goodie Mob, they were part of that Dungeon family in the 90s, put out a couple of the best hip-hop records of all time, Soul Food, Still Standing. In the 90s, and they're just so quintessentially Atlanta. We were just talking about Atlanta United. Well, I'm part of Footy Mob that's named after them. So, yes, it's going to be a great time.
Okay, we'll leave you with Goodie Mob, Cell Therapy with Josh Jackson. Thank you so much.